Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent. This week, we're bringing you a student voice.
Hi, I'm Strong Ma. I'm a TLA at Harvard Law School.
Hi, I'm Julia Saltzman, and I'm also a TLA at Harvard Law School.
We're here today to talk about programs the federal government has funded to provide legal information to non-citizens involved in immigration proceedings. It's a blog post that Julia has written about. So, Julia, I'm just really curious, why did you pick this topic?
Yeah, thanks, Strong, and thanks for being here with me today. So, prior to law school, I worked at several immigration nonprofits. I loved the work and loved working directly with people who were seeking safety, opportunity, and family reunification in the U.S. And I'm also broadly interested in programs that help pro se litigants, since one of the biggest themes from my work prior to law school was seeing how the demand for immigration representation far outpaced the supply. So yeah, just to give you an idea of that, at one job I had at 9 a.m. on Monday mornings, we opened intake for consultations for that week. And most weeks we had to close intake by 9:05 a.m. just because we had so many interested callers.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, immigration nonprofits are even more pressed now. So through this prior work, I have known about these information programs that are targeted towards helping people navigate the complexities of immigration proceedings for those who are not lucky enough to get a lawyer. But I wanted to highlight these programs and look into what evidence is already out there about their efficacy.
So, I mean, just to start us off, could you just give us a broad description or overview of just how this process works from the perspective of someone without a lawyer, perhaps?
Yeah, so just to provide an example, and everyone's experience is different, but for why these legal information programs may matter from the perspective of someone who was recently detained by ICE, which is the enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security. So imagine you were just released on bond from jail. After you're released, ICE picks you up. You're then transported to a faraway detention center that looks just like the jail you just left. You have no idea where you are or why you're there. You've been told by ICE officials you're going to see a judge. You're waiting, and you don't know what's going to happen during that hearing, and you might not even know who that judge is, if they're for your criminal case or your immigration case. Perhaps you don't speak English fluently or face additional challenges such as literacy or mental health disabilities that prevent you from understanding the immigration proceedings that you're currently forced to navigate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that just sounds like an awful circumstance to be in, and a really helpful way to, you know, set the stage to see just how confusing and generally just frightening these situations can be for people entangled in the immigration system.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also talk a little bit about what immigration court looks like. So one thing that's different from criminal court is that in immigration court, people who are going through proceedings have no guaranteed right to counsel, which means that even if they don't speak English or have no legal background, they have to fight their case for themselves. On the other side, there's an attorney from the Department of Homeland Security whose job is to deport that person or deny them the relief that they're applying for.
I mean, that sounds really quite, you know, crazy just to think about, because it seems to me, like the consequences seem fairly dire. And I know in the criminal context from Gideon that there is a right to counsel for criminal defendants. So can you speak a little bit about just how the reasoning might even check out, if at all, between giving not these immigration proceedings not having a right to counsel?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So, for example, in Padilla versus Kentucky, the majority recognized how dire the consequences of immigration proceedings are, describing deportation as a drastic measure. But at the same time, the Supreme Court has never extended the right to counsel, which is afforded to criminal defendants in serious cases, to immigration cases.
So I'd love to just get a little bit more information about the specific legal programs and the information that they provide and what you've been sort of talking and researching about for your blog post.
Yeah, so I want to just start by saying that one of the reasons I was particularly interested in talking about these programs now is that about a week after President Trump's inauguration, he issued a stop work order. So this is now a couple months ago, to stop these programs that have actually been funded for almost 2 decades now, receiving bipartisan support. From Congress. And so, as you can imagine, chaos ensued for these providers that have been providing services to non-citizens navigating immigration proceedings. And within days, providers and advocates filed a lawsuit, and then the Trump administration actually revoked its decision just days later. So, one of the reasons I wanted to talk more about these programs is because they're safe for now, but they are under threat. So, to jump into what the programs do, there's four different programs that the Trump administration recently revoked, and they all do something slightly different, but aim to provide non-citizens navigating the immigration process with basic legal information. So, they do this through group orientations. Sort of like know your rights presentations to people who are both detained and people who aren't detained. And they also provide pro se assistance. So that might look like helping fill out forms or helping make sure that individuals are getting the correct information on where and when to send filings to immigration court, and also connecting people with pro bono attorneys were available.
So the eligibility for these programs are, is a individual going through these proceedings eligible for multiple of them at once? Are there sort of qualities or qualifications they need to sort of satisfy to be able to participate in these programs?
Yeah, so anyone who is without an attorney and seeking services where they're available can so that's an important point, though, that these services are not available in every immigration detention center, nor are they available at every immigration court. So only certain individuals will have any access to these legal information programs.
Yeah, got it. I mean, but it certainly sounds like these programs are, useful for the individuals who do receive them. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the benefits that accrue to some of these individuals?
Yeah, again, it definitely depends on the individual, but to give a couple examples, through the orientation or individual consultation, the legal information provider can help identify when someone is eligible for relief. So, for example, if someone is eligible for asylum, the provider can help the person understand how to submit an application and what evidence to gather to support their claim. As another example, perhaps the legal information provider recognizes that someone has a more complex claim and they might need to be connected with a pro bono attorney. And it also can be some of those more, I guess, mechanical aspects of going through immigration court, which I'm sure you're very familiar, are part of every legal process, this minutiae of how to fill out a form and things that we receive formal training for, but those who are going through immigration proceedings might have no background on even how to maybe send a letter.
Yeah, I mean, even as someone with quote-unquote formal training, some of these forms and legal proceedings escaped me for all intents and purposes. Yeah, and another thing we've sort of been talking a little bit in Access to Justice in this lab is it's not just the person going through proceedings, right? It's the entire system. And so, like, there's tons of other actors in it. And so what are the impacts of these services on these other actors, you know, say the judge or lawyers on our side?
Yeah, from anecdotal experiences shared by immigration judges really like these programs because it helps them with going through their dockets and caseload management, and just helps so that every individual that an immigration judge sees has some background on what the proceeding might look like. Also, some of this more logistical stuff, the legal information providers help identify those who will need an interpreter for immigration court, or help identify individuals who need additional protections in immigration court due to their serious mental health condition. And perhaps surprising to me that I hadn't thought about prior to looking more into these programs, even ICE officials tend to anecdotally support these programs because it means that those officials, while dealing with managing a detention center, are getting less inquiries about an individual's case or how to navigate the legal proceedings.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like just having people who are more familiar with the system and know how to get through it is a very broad benefit. You know, just getting the system working a little bit smoother, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially those who are concerned about the giant backlog facing our nation's immigration courts would appreciate the potential ways that these programs can make immigration courts function just a little bit better. I think the backlog now is over 3.6 million cases. So I think another thing that these programs have been lauded as cost-saving mechanisms.
I was going to ask about that because, you know, these are programs that have to be provided by the government, and a common refrain is that they cost money. But, you know, one thing I found fascinating about your blog post was that these actually save money to the system.
Yeah, and I think that what some evaluations of the program have said is that these legal information programs help facilitate the immigration relief process, they speed up immigration court proceedings, and decrease the time that non-citizens spend in detention. So all of this amounts to taxpayers are spending less money.
Yeah, and so that point about the cost savings is really interesting. And I know from reading your blog post that this research on the cost savings is not uncontested. Can you talk a little bit more about the ways they sort of figured this out, and if it may even be controversial about whether it's correct or not that these programs save money?
Yeah, I found this part really interesting. So back in 2018, the Trump administration then did something very similar to what they just did last month and revoked the funding for these programs, and then revoked that decision just weeks later after advocates in Congress voiced their concern. So as part of that scuffle, the federal government funded a subsequent review of these programs and specifically found that one of the programs actually caused people to spend more time in detention and their cases in immigration court took longer to complete, which in turn drives up taxpayer costs. However, in response, there was a counter study performed by the Vera Institute of Justice, who was then running LOP. And their study found with 99% certainty that LOP participants actually resolved their cases more quickly. So the main thing that the Vera study called out, the EOIR, which is the Department of Justice sub-agency that funds these programs, the thing that they called out about EOIR's study was that EOIR reviewed cases that were still pending at the time of study. So what that means is, especially with the large backlog of cases in immigration court and how long some of these cases take to resolve, they're basically undercounting.
Got
So
it.
Vera, while considering all the pending cases as well as completing cases using a statistical technique called survival analysis, was able to more accurately reflect case duration times, which in turn showed that non-citizens who participate in LOP do in fact resolve their cases more quickly and thus reduce taxpayer costs.
That's super interesting. It seems like it's just one of those instances where it's people trying to use statistics and research, but there always seems to be a way to harness it do it in a way that doesn't quite seem to be, and like there has to be a lot of research to be done to criticize and critique all these different times. But I think what's the most interesting part about your blog post is that a lot of this research about, the efficiency and the cost savings may even be beside the point.
Exactly. And yeah, just to go back to your earlier point, one of the things that Professor Greiner told us as we were discussing this was that the method that EOIR did by dropping cases still pending at the time was ludicrous. So I think it was necessary for Vera to issue the counter study. But I definitely hope to see future studies that are focusing on aspects of these programs beyond the length of case or the length of someone's stay in detention. Arguments that legal information programs save taxpayers money are important, especially if we want Congress to keep funding these programs. But I think it does, in some way, obscure the due process and humanitarian protections that these programs provide.
Yeah, no, and just there's an efficiency argument, but there's also fundamentally just justice, right?
Yeah, so I think that, and something that I talk about in the bottom of my blog post is that the content of our research or evaluations of these programs should shift. And there's ways to both quantitatively and qualitatively measure how people are interacting with legal information programs and if it is really helping people understand the process more, obtain relief quicker, or perhaps at a higher rate of success. So I'd really love to see more research on that in the future, which can hopefully be a tool for advocates as they fight against potential future attacks to the programs.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, just to close, I think that these legal information programs, although limited, can be necessary for individuals that are navigating the complex, adversarial, and high-stakes system that our immigration system is. And I would love to see more research focused on their efficacy in terms of helping protect due process and access to justice. And thanks so much, Strong, for talking about this with me today.
Yes, thank you so much. I really loved your blog post and I really thought it was so interesting and so important. And so thanks for coming on and talking about it.
Thanks.
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
And this is the work we do day to day. We so far have prevented 125,000 missed court dates across the country. We talked about savings. We estimate it's about 357 million saved. And this is what we do day to day. We want to help directly. We work with courts, advocates, policymakers to bring these interventions across the country. And so if anyone would like any support or has any questions, you can reach out to us at unwarranted@ideas42.org.